accession number 20596, Reel 2.
Mr. Somerset, Reel 2.
Not because they were light infantry, but because the Black Buttons, the Rifle Brigade, the 60th, and the Oxen and Bucks were all, I think, motorised battalions in armoured divisions. Their training was different. Either that or some of the Oxen and Bucks were in 6th Airborne, but they were not ordinary infantry regiments. Now, I was commissioned into the Shropshires, who were light infantry.
So you mean you wanted to go into the Oxfordshire?
Well, I would naturally, because I'd been born and brought up in Oxford, I would naturally have gone in the Oxen and Bucks. But if I'd thought about it, what I ought to have done earlier on was have done what some of my friends did, which was they volunteered for the 60th or the Rifle Brigade. And then they went off to a different octal and did a different training. But I thought their way of going in the army was a slightly underhand, in that I wanted to go to the ranks. I wanted to see what it was like in the ordinary way. Rather than these chaps sort of volunteered from school, and the idea was that they were going to, that they went straight to a sort of officer cadet unit of some kind or other. It wasn't actually an octal, but I just allowed myself to be called up and just let the army do with me whatever they liked, until they said, well, would you go to this WASB, this War Office Selection Board for officers? I wanted to see what the ranks were like. Well, I enjoyed it, actually.
What was so enjoyable about being in the ranks?
Well, just mixing with people that I never met before. I love the expression how about the Penguin? Who the bloody hell's that down the other end of the barrack room, talking all seven and a tanner? There's a lovely description of the Queen's King's English, sort of all talking all seven and a tanner. And then there were one or two. There was a chap who said this in the barrack room said, somehow, I can imagine someone keeping it up like that for a bit, but how do you manage to do it all the time? I like that kind of thing. And there was a great buddy of mine at Newtown, Woody, came from Leicester. He'd got 14 convictions for cat burglary. And I can well believe it, because we had something wrong with our stove one evening, and Woody was up on the roof, sort of sorting out Woody soon put the chimney of our stove in order, but we had two coppers in the hut, both Geordies, and when they heard of Woody's criminal record, they said, announce the hut, watch your kit, chaps. And Woody said, don't worry, I've been through it already, and none of you have got anything worth having. I thought it was quite splendid. Yeah, he's a lovely man. I once lent Woody $5, and I was sure that I'd never get it back, but of course I did. £5 then was rather more than it is now, in that it was 2 days' pay. Of course, we were paid half a crown a day. And remember, you didn't actually get 17 and 6 at the end of the week. What you got was 14 shillings, because 3 and 6 pence went to your credits, lest you should die in debt. Remember in the First War, when you buried a soldier in Flanders, you sent the family a bill 4 shillings for the blankets in which he was bedded, or so my father assured me.
Now, you were telling me about being commissioned into the...
I was commissioned in the Shropshires, yes. Well, I was actually... I was posted to a TA battalion at the Shropshires, which was actually heavy infantry and not light infantry, the 2nd Herefords. And they were down in Kent and just beginning to take part in an exercise called Harlequin. And the object of that exercise was to test the English side of sending waves of troops tide by tide across the channel. And I think the object of holding it in Kent was, of course, to increase the effectiveness of our deception plan to persuade the Germans that we were going to invade straight across the Channel and not into Normandy. I think that was one of the reasons for holding the exercise there. So what we did, I was at Hatch Park. I think it belongs to Lord Brabourne, and a nice house. And every 12 hours, a fresh unit would come in to be fed, and if they came in the evening, to be billeted for the night under canvas. And then they would make their way down 12 hours later to catch the tide. But instead of, they'd go down to the Hards, and of course instead of actually going over to France, they would disperse. I don't know how this dispersion took place, but it went on for about a week, and we had, I don't remember any infantry units. I remember one ill-organized light AK-AK regiment that left behind a quad, that's the towing vehicle, and a Bofors, I suppose it was. That would be right, wouldn't it? Light AK-AK. A complete quad and Bofors gun, and I think a gun. So that we were left with 2 guns and a quad, and they'd just gone off without them. Charming commanding officer, but I learned one thing at that little transit camp, and that was that if you meet the unit, you can usually guess what the CO will be like, and if you meet the CO, you can usually guess what the unit will be like. That AK-AK battery, AK-AK regiment, had a charmingly clueless commanding officer, and it went right through the regiment. That regiment was so bad that I had personally, for someone, to go and wake their regimental sergeant major in the morning to sort of start things going. I didn't quite like to go and wake the CO. So I worked the regimental sergeant major to sort of get them moving. And as I say, even then, they left a quad and a couple of guns behind. I don't know how they managed it. Anyway, nor do I. I don't know how we disposed. I suppose somebody came back and collected them in due course. But anyway, that was that. Well, then, after that exercise, we went back to our basic function, which was coastal defence on the highs, I'm trying to think of the names of it. It's Sandown down there somewhere, on that sort of Kentish coast, just opposite some...
Sandlin?
Sandown, is that right? Or am I thinking of the Isle of Wight, which is another place?
I think there's a place they call Sandling, maybe.
Hythe, I think, was where we had our company mess. Well, then from there, this was still the sort of autumn of 1943, we went up to Amersham, where we did a little bit more training. Then we had to make way for 51st Highland Division, which had come back, been brought back from Italy. And now at last there were some people, not that we benefited from it, but there were some people in the country who'd actually seen some action. But of course they kept together as a division, so they weren't actually available to instruct. And from there we went up to Anmouth, a dear little place on the Northumbrian coast, where we were made extraordinarily welcome by the people.
This is still the second Hereford?
This is still the dear old Herefords, yes. Well, our chaps were a nice, quiet country lot, and the reason, I think, why we were so popular was because our predecessors had been a battalion of the Cameronians, which were a pretty rough lot. And they were, we really had a marvellous Christmas up there. We were awfully nicely looked after. And while I was there, I went up to we had a divisional battle school up somewhere near Rothbury is the name of the place that sticks in my mind. Again, very nice part of the world, up in the foothills of the Cheviots. And there again, the instructors did their best, but there wasn't a man amongst them who had seen any active service. I did think it was a weakness. The trouble in the last war, there were so until very late in the war, there were so few people available to tell you about war, what happens. These people, they'd all been through numerous courses and so on. Presumably they'd been at the School of Infantry at Barnard Castle and so on. But they knew more about war than I do. Than I did. Anyway, from there, we went. We went down to the Isle of Wight. That's right, Sandown and Shanklin. That's where the name Sandown comes, where we were billeted. And our job there was to guard the British end of the Pluto pipeline. Now, of course, we didn't know that it was going to be a pipeline under the channel. We knew that it was highly inflammable, and we assumed it was petrol, because we actually had an NFS man in our mess, in our company mess, and we could see these pipes. They were going. They went out on to the end of the piers, Sandown and Shanklin. What we assumed was going to happen was that petrol tankers would come to the end of the pier and fill themselves up with fuel and take that to wherever it was required. But of course, later on, we discovered that in fact they laid a pipe right under the channel. The stuff was coming up in Normandy, but we didn't know that at the time. We saw, of course, while we were there, we saw huge build-up of craft of all kinds in the Solent, and we were still there. But D-Day, I remember the actual night of the 5th, 6th of June because of the numbers of aircraft going overhead. By then, our commanding officer had decided that it would be good for us if we actually lived in the open, so we were up on Franklin Down, I think it was called. The whole battalion moved up there, and we lived under this sort of bivouac up there. Well, then, sometime in June, the battalion was broken up. We had a party, and we went off to reinforcement holding units. And most of the Herefords, including my platoon, which actually at that time I was pioneer platoon commander, I hadn't got a rifle platoon. I'd been pioneer platoon commander, I think, most of the time we were in the Isle of Wight, and I'd done two courses. I'd done a course up at Ripon on mines, and I'd done a course on sort of basic explosives, Bangalore torpedoes, pole charges, beehives, and so on. We had a local divisional pioneer platoon course, Black Gang, Chine, or somewhere on the Isle of Wight. I remember one absurd episode there. We were learning how to do a camouflage, you know, blow a crater. And I'd made my little camouflage and things like that, and I'd filled it up with ammonol or amatol or whatever the explosive you use for these large crater, and brought back my electrical wires to plunger. And in my heart, I knew that I wasn't really far enough away from this crater that was to be. And I imagine other people have done the same thing and believe that if you push the plunger down gently, the explosion won't be so great. Anyway, I pushed it down gently. It didn't modify the explosion at all. And I remember the air being full of bits, and mostly sort of shale, quite lumpy bits. And the instruction, of course, is that you look up so that you can dodge the bits. But there were so many bits that there was no dodging this lot. And fortunately, the worst I got was a very bruised leg. I didn't get anything on my head or anywhere where it had to. But the rest of the day, I had to try and conceal the fact that I had got a very bruised leg, because clearly I'd made a grave mistake in the rolling out of this electrical thing. Yes, the pioneer platoon was enormous fun. My pioneer platoon sergeant, Sherrett, was so good that he'd actually been an instructor at Ripon, you know, the RE school at Ripon. And I had a Corporal Biggs, who was old enough to be my father, and he used to fuss around so that I didn't get hurt. He was a lovely little man. He'd been a miner, so he'd been dealing with explosives all his life. Well, I went off to a reinforcement holding unit at Aldershot with the mortar platoon commander, a chap called Harry Fox. In those, you know, the mortars, pioneers, carriers, anti-tank were all in a thing called support company. He, of course, hadn't been a rifle platoon commander either. And there we made friends with a chap called, two chaps, Colin Rudd and Mike Booth. I mentioned them because they were both in the North Staffords afterwards. We kicked our heels in Aldershot for much longer than we expected, because at the end of June there was a storm which slowed up the reinforcement of Second Army to in no small degree, and I believe did quite a lot of damage to the Mulberry and so on. So we didn't actually leave Aldershot until July 11th, 12th. We sailed from Newhaven in, I think it was called an LSI, it was a landing ship infantry, it was American, nice sort of veteran Americans. They'd been in the landing at one of the Sicilian landings, and they'd been at Salerno, and they'd been at Anzio, and so on. And all that. Of course, by then, there was no question of us. We weren't going to be, our landing would be purely unopposed. In fact, when we arrived at whatever, I can't remember now, it was King or Sword or Juno, whichever beach it was, the captain of the LSI said, wait an hour or two, the tide will go out, and you'll get you won't get your feet wet, which is exactly what we did. Put the ramp down, just wait for the tide to go out, and we could step in. So, two impressions of the actual sort of scene on the beaches was the quantity of shipping was absolutely astonishing, and of course, as every ship had a barrage balloon, the number of barrage balloons. It really was a very, very crowded scene. We walked off the beaches. Oh, I had a draft, I think, of some Yorkshire regiment to sort of take to the reinforcement holding. Sergeant, and I suppose a platoon, nothing to do with me. We walked up off the beaches with a minefield beside us, and with German wire. And, I don't know if you're familiar with German wire, much, much thicker than ours, around it. Achtung Minen. And see, I noticed being a pioneer platoon officer, I noticed about these mines was it was quite obvious where every mine was, because there was a little pile of rabbit shit on top of it. I'm quite certain of this. The pattern of a German minefield was exactly worked out in this rabbit shit. And I can only suppose the rabbits enjoyed a warm latrine. I don't think I could have been wrong about this, that the Germans are very orderly people, and when I'd learnt as a pioneer platoon officer what the pattern of a German minefield would be, and it's exactly replicated, but little piles of junk. Anyway, interesting thing, one of the officers with us, a chap called John Sale, who's a regular KS&I, still only a captain. When we got to the top of the beach, he saw a 3rd Division vehicle going past, and 3 did. They had a sort of triangle with another triangle inside it as their divisional. He just flagged this thing down, and I don't know what unit it belonged to, and he just waved to us and said, sort of, see you later, chaps. And I'll just complete the story of John Sale. Because when we arrived at the reinforcement holding unit somewhere outside Bayeux, the commander of the RHU, who's a Canadian, suitable chap to have because he spoke good French, said, where's Captain Sale? So I said, well, sir, Captain Sale is a regular officer. I left you at that. And that evening, this Canadian colonel said, I've just had a message from the commander of 2nd KS&I saying briefly, Captain Sale has rejoined his regiment. That was the way a regular soldier did things. John was not going to join any unit but his own. We were just, we weren't regulars, we hadn't any regiment, you see. I mean, the fact that I was commissioned KSLI would count it for nothing. I'd never been with the 2nd KSLI. I was just available to be posted anywhere. But I was interested to see that. So John just flagged down a 3rd Division vehicle and off he went and joined his own regiment. Well, we got to this RHU. By then, you could sometimes hear guns, but you really, this was mid-July, I wouldn't say the guns were much louder. You can sometimes hear guns at Lark Hill, depending on the wind here. The battle had moved quite a long way from Bayeux. And we were there for about a week, I suppose. Had nasty belly aches from water, I remember. There. And I was posted to 6 North Staffords. And I'm slightly confused by that bit of paper I gave you, but I must have joined them after their second battle. They only fought 3 real battles. They had a very hard battle, their first one, at La Bidoude outside Caen, early in July. And then in mid-July, shortly before I joined them, they had a fairly easy battle outside Villers-Bocage. And as described to me, the German troops against them weren't of top quality. And the Germans were subjected to the entire corps artillery was concentrated on this unfortunate German brigade, or whatever it was, regiment, I suppose the Germans called it, for 2 days, plus a couple of army group, agros, army group Royal Artillery, and they really did hammer them. So you get that sort of concentration. People can't sleep, they can't get meals, they don't have a shit, you know, it really life is. And in consequence, I don't know the exact figures, but they mopped up, I think the battalion took 250 prisoners for a loss of 10 or a dozen men. It was a fairly easy battle. And I joined them at night, and my company commander, of whom more later, John Towers, sent me off to get a rum ration. And of course, by then, the battalion had lost a lot of its officers, and so that the quartermaster wouldn't necessarily know the officer. And so it was in the dark, and I was treated with suspicion. He flashed a torch in my face, and I remember him feeling up with his hand for my badges of rank. Before he would let me have this rum ration. Anyway, that was by the way. Well, then we took over from 7th South Staffords, who were the other battalion in our brigade, 177 Brigade, I think it was, at a place called La Senevière. And La Senevière was the name of the farm. And the battalion front was rather strange because we were somewhere on the right flank and the enemy was nearly a mile away. So we had quite a lot of bocage, these thick fences. Some of them are sort of double fence, double hedge. And in those days, of course, a lot of elm trees. It was very thick wooded, but thick
thick country, not nice for infantrymen if they've got to do the advancing. But there are quite a lot of hedges between us and the enemy. And as I say, I think they must have been about